All right, here we go. Well, good morning again to you. Thank you for those of you who returned from the previous session and those of you who came from somewhere else, which I think includes everybody at that point. We're going to introduce ourselves in a minute, but this is a discussion of preaching and particularly prophetic preaching and how one might go about doing something that seems dangerous. All of us want to do it, but we struggle to figure out how. And so we're going to try to talk about that. My name is Mark Hamilton, and I teach Old Testament here at ACU. I am a student of John Willis, whose shoes I'm not following in, can't actually, but I can carry shoelaces, maybe. That's all I can do. But I'm glad. Thank you, John, for coming. And I'm going to let my colleagues introduce themselves. Today we're going to talk about prophetic preaching, but we're going to focus on narrative. So we'll talk well among ourselves, and then we'll open this conversation up to the rest of us, because it should be a dialogue, not just a... It should be a multi-leveled conversation, let's put it that way. But let's begin with prayer, and then we'll let Tim and Stephen introduce themselves. Our God, we thank you for today and for this time we have together. We thank you for the call of preaching, because we know that it is the way in which you have decided to share the good news with the whole world. We pray that you will bless the feet of those who bring good tidings. We pray that you will bless us today as we reflect on how to preach so that our preaching will grow stronger and more effective, not because we are more eloquent, but because we are better able to listen to what you're doing in the world. Thank you for these colleagues of mine and for their wonderful creativity and example. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Tim, you want to go?
Tim Finsing. I've been preaching for 17 years full-time and then teaching here for 10 years, where I hear more sermons, I guess, maybe than I've ever preached. But I care deeply about preaching, feel very strongly about preaching. And I guess I'm the oldest one of this group, and so it'll be my task to bring some gravity to their wild thoughts and propositions.
Thanks, Tim.
It's hard to know how to respond to that.
Yeah,
isn't it, really?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But that would be good if you brought some gravity. I'm Stephen Johnson. I've been teaching here for, this would be my eighth year teaching here at ACU. Spent a part of that time away doing PhD studies in homiletics in Toronto. I've preached for churches here in West Texas, in Wichita Falls, San Antonio, New Market, Ontario, and currently preach most Sundays in Buffalo Gap, just south of town. One of the great delights of my life and work is to share the journey of life and faith and the Word of God with brothers and sisters in Buffalo Gap. So it's a nice mix for me of teaching, preaching, and worship and other things here, and then being involved in ministry as well, and standing alongside some really, really brilliant and creative people like Mark and Tim. So this is going to be fun.
This is going to be fun. We have not rehearsed every bit of this, which is a nice professorial way of saying we haven't
rehearsed any of this.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll see how this goes. But we want to have a conversation about, again, today, beginning talking about narrative preaching. And we're going to look at Genesis 18, the text that I talked about in this class yesterday. And so if you want to read, follow along with us, that'd be a good thing to do. And if you decide you don't like what we're doing, why, there's always Genesis 19 to go into. Genesis 18, just to remind us, is the story about the conversation between God and Abraham about whether it would be appropriate to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah and over in what circumstances. So it's really a discussion about two things. What sort of God is this? What does it mean to say God is righteous? And also, what sort of human being is this whom chapter 15 describes as righteous? Abraham. And what does it mean to be just or righteous? So let me start the conversation, and we'll just see how this goes. As the two of you, we'll give each of you a chance, as you look at this text, what are some of the things you would want to ask yourself first? What are the processes you might go through first in thinking about how to preach this text?
I defer to my older colleague. That one's going to come back.
Yeah, I wanted to be corrected rather than initiate conversations.
Thank you, Tim.
When I first think about Genesis 18, when I first read the text, the first thing that really popped out into my mind was something that I probably hadn't thought about before, because I've looked at sermons. When you have a computer, you can remember what you've preached before, which is a frightful thing to actually go back and see what you may have said in times past. But I've concentrated upon this conversation that God has with Abraham and talked about prayer and intercession, and that's the way I've approached it. But when I read it for this class, by Mark framing the question in terms of justice, then this word righteousness and justice came to me stronger than I had seen it before, and so it was fresh. I wanted to read it with fresh eyes, thinking about it in ways maybe I hadn't seen it before. But what came is this early reminder of what had gone on before in the story. Verse 17, the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do, seeing that Abraham shall become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth will be blessed in him?" And so that reminder of what had already transpired hit me stronger than it had hit me before. Maybe because when I preached through Genesis before, I'd already touched on some of those themes, and therefore was trying to move on to something different. Mm-hmm. And maybe then, in some sense, take this text out of context. But when the first thing I did once I saw that verse, then, was I started rereading Genesis primarily at 12. Mm-hmm. And started picking up the promise of the nation. And then you have, prior to this story, the story of the announcement of the birth of Isaac with the three visitors earlier in the chapter. And so I then brought up again a recollection of a theme in terms of whenever you're having a promise of the nation, you seem to almost always have an interruption and somehow a delay that it's not going to happen right now. And so how does this story then function as a delay of what happened in the previous story? So putting it into some type of context was the first place I began.
Yep. Okay, good.
I think for me to always have sort of like an operating system playing beneath all of this are these questions that really these narratives are a way of getting at: who is God? Who are the people of God? Who are we? And even at some level, what is the world? Right. And what we have before us in Genesis, in this text, is not a response to those questions that is a proposition. I think that'd be one way of doing it, to make an assertion,
right,
just in a propositional statement. But you have a story. You're invited into a story that's trying to get at this in some way. And the story has its own way of propelling us forward, but it's unique. It's not functioning like just making this claim. God is, boom, there it is. There are other places where you get propositions made. But stories invite us into them. And so for me, it is to remind myself of the nature of story, which is echoing, I think, in a different sort of way what Tim was saying, and that this text is not isolated from a larger story that's going on in Genesis, for instance. So can I locate it there?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's possible. Here's a proposition. To read an individual text like Genesis 18 and interpret it in a way that contradicts the larger story that holds it.
Right.
So, I think to find our bearings, I may be stating the obvious here, but you did say a beginning place.
Yeah, no,
so
it's
good. Is to maybe even sit down and make sure, even though we may think this is familiar territory, Genesis, that we've got a sense of the plot line. Mm-hmm. And having done that, then, to immerse ourselves in the particular part of the story that is the text for preaching. And pay attention to its unique plot line. So maybe we've said something a little bit differently in that Tim said that, if I'm hearing you right, Tim said that engaging this particular text gave him some narrative clues that sent him back to consider the larger narrative. And I've said sort of just the opposite. And I think it works, but we might want to talk about the difference.
Yes.
Between the two. So.
Well, it's always a circle, isn't it? I'm always asking myself, so how does this fit in the overarching story? Part of it means I have to keep reading Genesis, don't I? Or whatever my text is. But I'm interested in that. I've heard it said, there are lumpers and there are splitters. Are you a lumper or a splitter?
Do you know what you've got?
Well, he's a curveball pitcher, maybe. I don't know.
Oh.
But which?
How many of you knew what that meant? One.
An enigma wrapped in a riddle. Yeah. Well, what I mean is, some of us start with the big picture and move in, and some of us start with the little pieces and we move out.
Right.
Isn't that what I'm hearing?
Right.
The two of you. And so maybe part of what I have to do as a preacher is figure out which one of those two things I am and manage by going the other direction.
And the reality is, wouldn't you say that something of both is going on, regardless of where you start?
It always happens, but I guess when I think about preaching Sunday after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, and oftentimes Sunday morning and Sunday night, the problem with Sunday is they come every week when you're a preacher. And there are a lot of these.
That depends on the preacher, of course.
Depends on the preacher.
Yeah, it does.
But after one Sunday, another one may not come.
Yeah, right. That's right. That's right.
But and you think about 50 Sundays, you get 2 weeks vacation. Although if you're like me, you're on vacation, they find out you're a preacher, they want you to preach there too. But so you're talking about 90 to 100 of these preps every year. And then if you're teaching class and writing a church bulletin article, there's a lot of prep going on every week. Mm-hmm. And it's an exhausting work.
Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of the realities of it, I'm almost always starting with a particular text. And hopefully my memories will move me outward.
Yeah.
Rather than having the luxury of always being outward and then always honing back down.
Right.
I don't know if I always have those luxuries week in and week out.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
Can I say one other thing?
Sure.
I also, when I teach on the undergraduate level, students who are preparing for ministry, sort of an introductory preaching class, and we talk about engaging the text for preaching, and I think beginning place matters, and it's not so much whether you begin broad or narrow, but how your posture in relationship to the text. And I encourage them for their first move with the text to be a prayerful one, to be how would one say this without it miscommunicating? I want their first engagement with the text to be a spirited engagement with the text.
We did rehearse this, actually.
Thanks for confirming that nicely.
Thank you.
So,
sorry.
So how do I immerse myself?
You heard about the preacher whose phone went off at a funeral, didn't you?
No, tell us.
And the tune was Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. Sorry,
no.
I just couldn't resist that.
I hadn't heard that one.
Well, it's bad. Go.
Where was I?
I don't know.
Spirited engagement with
yes,
the text,
thank
I think
you.
I was saying. If early on my first step with the text can be pray it. And I don't mean to, dear God, help me to understand this text better, pray it. I mean that the world of this text becomes the world of prayer, becomes the world of reflection. And so that's a little bit different thing than we were talking about, but,
but
first engagement with the text. And I even try and get students, I'm not very successful, to spend time early in the week memorizing significant portions of it, because I think internalizing, you know, to use the language of to devour, to savor the text, to mm-hmm. is a pretty good first move with these narratives. So
I want to piggyback that in a second. So I hear us saying that if I'm doing narrative preaching, I'm looking at the narrative at several levels, right? I'm looking at the text I have in front of me, the pericope in front of me. I'm looking at the narrative arc in which it fits somehow. I'm looking at my narrative arc as a preacher and in this church. And I'm looking at the narrative arc of the world that I find myself in. And then I've got to figure out how those things all relate to each other. Which sounds daunting, but
it's not easy.
But we do that. I mean, by practice, there's a sort of practice intuition that kicks in with this, right?
Right.
Now, let's start thinking about how we link those things. We're talking about engaging the text. So you go with me on this tour, if you will. If you read the text like this one, what sorts of things in it trigger your imagination, and why? Does that sound okay?
Yeah. Sounds good. I start with just some of the basic literary questions that you would ask any story or any narrative. You have to think about who the characters are in the story, and you did that yesterday. You made a list of PowerPoint slide mm-hmm. Of the various characters in the story. Mm-hmm. Once you think about characters, you have to think about those characters' relationships with one another. Mm-hmm. You have to think about plot line, and is there some type of sequencing that's going on? And when you think about sequencing, sometimes there are things in the story that I want to know that are not there, so I have to think about selection. Why did these particular aspects of this story get told, and what other aspects of the story did not get told?
Right.
And so often those gaps then create questions or points of imagination. But when you think about sequence selection, character development, you're looking at plot line. And so just basic literary kinds of questions that you would do with any type of story being told, any narrative being told, all those are aspects that have to be thought about. Not knowing when I start asking some of those kinds of questions where certain kinds of sparks of imagination take place.
Yeah.
And when I think about sparks of imagination, I mostly think about because there is this other narrative, the narrative of the congregation. What's difficult for me in teaching preaching is that I don't often have a particular congregation in mind, and to think about a sermon generically, like for this class,
right.
this lectureship class, generically, how do I preach Genesis 18? I don't have a context in mind, and therefore I don't have this other conversation going on. And so the pastoral ministry of being in someone's living room, eating pie that maybe I don't like, kinds of things. I think of one particular lady who always served me some type of milk pie. But sitting week in and in pastoral kinds of relationships, in a hospital room, in a living room, sometimes in my office, out at the park, those kinds of narratives of the congregation in which I'm actually serving, mm-hmm. Those are the stories and those are the narratives that then when I'm looking at the story and the text, then some imagination sparks start to be created.
Okay, thank you. Jump in there.
So let me just take one possibility in this text as maybe a kind of illustration of what Tim's talking about. The thing that strikes me as I read this text and consider the characters in the plot line is this is a conversation. It's back and forth. This is Abraham and God in dialogue. The interesting thing about this conversation is that though my reading is that God initiates this conversation, and I'm not sure if in verse 16, 17, when the Lord speaks, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do, seeing that Abraham shall become my great and mighty nation, that God is speaking to Abraham?
No, I think not.
I think this seems to me like speech God is having, or the narrator says God is having with himself.
Right.
He's considering this.
Right.
And then the dialogue happens between God and Abraham. Only here, Abraham seems, though with some humility and in a proper posture before God, negotiating with God, right? This is negotiation. And so one place that is conversation with God. Usually, I think as I'm considering this narrative and then how most of the people that I live and worship with think about this, that conversation with God is usually of the sort where God speaks and I listen. And God speaks and I listen. And, you know, I can imagine myself standing there with my head down, listening, and, yes, sir. And you nod your head. But this is a very different kind of conversation in which Abraham is actively engaging with this.
Right.
He's invited by God into this dialogue. And so one of the, I don't know if we would call it a twist of plot or not, but the narrative sparks for me is about what is, there's a certain thing about this conversation in this text that's a little bit troubling.
Yes.
What is Abraham doing here? And
Right. And
who is God that God would allow this kind of give and take, being bartered with almost?
Well, it's almost like he's buying a used car.
Yeah, that's
he's
the way.
He's trying to negotiate
the
price down.
That's the image I get.
Yeah.
And you don't see it with the other patriarchs. You don't see it with Isaac. You don't see it with Jacob. You don't see it with Joseph.
Well, if you're God, why would you let Jacob do that? I mean, he's a really troubling guy in a lot of ways. My guess is the Lord said, well, we have to meet him, but not all that often. I don't know that. I can't prove that.
So for me, let me just say that I'm looking for the place in the narrative where I sense trouble. Some trouble here. It's the tensive part of the plot.
All right.
To sort of reside for a while, that and I don't just pick that randomly, and it's not it's given to me by the text, but it's also given to me by my reading of the context as well.
Right.
So I'm sensing this about what's happening here.
I'm sensing.
Yes, you are.
I'm Tim sensing.
It's hard when you work with two would-be comedians. Yeah.
I'm sensing this in the text.
Yeah.
I'm also sensing it in the. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
In the life of the people that I'm called to serve and minister to and with.
Well, let's take that a bit. We're talking about things in the text that arrest us, so we're talking about posture in a way. It may be that the text itself is bothered by this, as though in this story maybe not so much. So it may be that I'm bothered by it because I have certain expectations, which I then want to work, examine, play with, play upon. But let's build a sermon for a minute. Can we do that? Let's brainstorm a sermon. You should never do this at home, by the way. What sorts of things might you, from your own experience outside the text, connect to the text? I gave one, used car salesman. Now this, of course, is very tricky because portraying God as someone with whom we don't always associate honesty is a problem. Right? Or as one of my favorite teachers of preaching says, it was Tim Sensing, says, no dog story can carry the weight of the gospel. Right? Which means telling a cute little story about my Scottish Terrier and using that as an analogy to the gospel is really bad theology and should be causes for dismissal, really, I think. Okay, so, but what sorts of things in your own experience just come to mind? Let's brainstorm a minute. Can we do that?
Sure.
Can we do that?
Well, I guess before I do that,
Yeah, okay.
Some prior types of things. When I think about narrative, I have to think about point of entry into the story.
Yes.
And that's what you're talking about. I am going to start with experience, and I'm going to start with the experience of the congregation, because I can't start really anywhere else other than my experience and the experience of the church in which I'm working.
Right.
And so, but that's going to think about point of entry. And so I have to ask some questions about point of entry, because point of entry happens in various ways and can change. The text has a point of entry. It has God asking this question to God's self about, should I have this conversation with Abraham? So that's a point of entry from God's perspective. But there could be another point of entry. I can take any one of the characters in the story and have point of entry different into the story. And once I have a different point of entry with one of those characters, the sermon will then have a point of view.
Right.
And that point of view has to be maintained. I don't think that you, in the middle of a sermon, one sermon, because this text has more than one sermon. Mm-hmm. And yet, on any given Sunday, just preach one of them. Don't preach more than one of them. No sermon can carry the weight of the entire text. And so you choose a point of entry, and once you have that point of entry, you have a point of view, and maintain that point of view throughout the sermon, because if you're going to switch point of entry, or you switch point of view, you'll give your congregation whiplash. And they don't know why they didn't follow you. But it's because you've made this shift in point of entry or point of view.
Right.
And so with my experience of my congregations that I have, then I may choose different places of point of entry that I see that are possible in the text as well, and also maintain point of view. For example, if I choose... what made this text emerge? Why do we have this text? And there's lots of different ways in which you can talk about that. You can talk about that in terms of the one I mentioned first, the nation, and what kind of just nation will this be, and will that be rooted into our ancestor? And if our ancestor is a righteous person, then we as the children, the nation, that will also be a blessing to other nations. We will be righteous people. And I can think about that. Are there places in my congregation where we need to function in righteous and just ways in order to be blessings to our neighbors that are around us in the church? Another point of entry could be the outcry. This story may emerge because God actually heard these prayers of oppressed people, and therefore God's investigating about this, the truth of this, of these outcries, of these prayers. And so then I can come back to my congregation and I say, well, another point of entry would be in my neighborhood, in this town which I'm living, and our congregation is to be a neighbor in this town, are there certain kinds of outcries that are being heard or being expressed? And so then those are experiences that bring me into a point of entry.
Okay.
And I would maintain a point of view throughout.
Okay.
And not change it.
And we saw this yesterday with David Fleer's sermon, right, in which he starts by talking about being at home in 1964, and we're talking about Uncle Carol's obstreperousness, I guess, and how we use the Bible for our own ends. Now, I thought that was a wonderful example of exactly what you're talking
point
about.
Of entry.
Yeah. Stephen, jump in there.
Yeah, I wrestle with this because it's possible that the way in which you begin the sermon, the point at which you begin the sermon, can either invite the congregation, the listening community, into the text itself, the world of the text, very closely or natively to that text, or in a way that's sort of removed by experience.
Right.
And I go back and forth, and I probably don't do one or the other every time, but my gut instinct, I was looking for some of my students I've had before who would be saying, why doesn't he say what he always that tells us? That if the first move in the sermon can be somehow to hold close to the vest, close in tight, the particularities of this text, so that we're sort of imagining this text, not as an ancient text or a distant text, but one that's near. And so,
right.
What language, what imagery in this text can I seize upon and actually allow it to be present? For instance, an example, a quick example. I hope it'll be quick. If I'm preaching from 1 Samuel, knowing what Dr. Willis taught me some years ago, that this is an assertion that God is king, as I recall. You correct me if I get you wrong. And that there are issues of control and things feeling a bit out of control. And one of the ways to try and maneuver for control is we've got to align ourselves in a particular way. And so I want to begin a sermon on that takes that general theme about God's control, even in the midst of when things seem to be spinning out of control. And I could begin by entering the narrative of the text in a way that draws us into the particularities of that text. Or I can begin in my world by saying, for instance, something like, the tilt-a-whirl is not my friend.
Yes.
And I remember when my daughter was 3 and we went to Funland in Wichita Falls, and it's one of those broken down carnivals that just went from place to place and then it broke down and stayed for years and years and years and years. I could tell a story, in other words,
right,
about how she gets on the tilt-a-whirl and it spins out of control and she turns green and I can't jump on fast enough to rescue her and all of that. But what that does is the primary metaphor, the primary image, the field of vision then is the tilt-a-whirl. And the text becomes a way of saying, oh, well, the text is like that. So I guess I'm wrestling with, I continue to wrestle with, are there beginning places with a text that draw us more closely into the particularities of the text so that we sort of dwell in it for a while before trying to... does that make sense?
It makes good sense.
Did I jump track, though?
No, I think we've all had this experience where we listen to a sermon and we remember the stories that didn't actually have anything to do with the text or the sermon.
I'm not sure what the Bible was saying, but I remember that story about the tilt-a-whirl really well.
Right.
And the question becomes, well, does it matter that they remember one or the other? And I
think it matters.
Does.
I think it matters. And that doesn't mean I don't use the story of a tilt-a-whirl, though like you, I don't. They make me green too. But I don't want the controlling image to be nausea. Unless it's a text about nausea. Right. I mean, it might carry, but I always have to ask, does this fit here? Does it?
Right.
And the text is what's driving this.
Right. Now, I think there are ways that, I mean, so you're thinking, so you begin the sermon by sort of doing this descriptive past tense work. Here's Abraham who lived a long time ago and had this, you know, he's an ancient figure. I mean, I'm exaggerating here, but you begin describing in past tense the text.
Right.
There are other ways to stand in relationship to the text in which the characters and the language of the text is present tense. So not Abraham was, but here is Abraham. And so he's present in our hearing. He's present in our midst. And so to pay attention to the tense of our telling of the text.
From is, not was.
Right. Yeah. Makes the text present in the midst of the people of God. And so I check I tell my students, check your tenses.
Right.
Because the past tense, while it may be necessary at times, you have to understand what it's doing. It's distancing the text from the community of faith. And so the preacher's job, as I see it, at least part of it, is to allow the text to be present, to allow this plot line to become not just Abraham's plot line, but our plot line and his questions and his wrestling to become our questions and our wrestling. So those are my...
So then if I leave this sermon you preached for me, I go away thinking, what do I care enough about to argue with God about? And how would I do that? Now let me exercise a little executive leadership here. I sometimes like being decisive and sometimes I don't. But now I'll be decisive. I've decided to be decisive, which I thought was funny, but clearly wasn't. Let, let's open it up. Do we have the courage to open it up to everybody else? Let's talk together about this. Ask anything you want, make any comment you want within reason. Yes, sir.
Sure, the entry point of many texts is often about 21st century application. Rather than say, well, this is a story of Abraham, which is this is a story about us. The things that were written before time were written for our learning.
Right.
This is our story.
Right.
What is the 21st application? And then working back to back to Abraham. It's okay to argue with God. There are people within our congregations who are sitting every week questioning God. And they think their faith's lost because they have questions.
Right.
The Bible teaches throughout. It's okay to ask God. It's okay to argue with God.
God can handle it, right? Well, and I think I hear us also pushing a bit on the word application, however, because at least the way I was taught preaching back long ago was, well, you make 3 points. The text could make 11 points or just one, but you make 3 points. I think it's better to say the sermon should make at least one, right? One is good. It should have a point. But it would be nice if it corresponded with the point of the text.
There's a couple words I don't use.
Yeah.
One of those words I don't use is illustration. The problem with illustration is that stories work. That's the reason the Bible uses stories, is because they work. And the illustrations as stories that help us to understand something more clearly as an illustration then can dominate. And that's the reason why people, when they go and they remember. Now, instead of illustration, I'll use the word image. I'll use the word metaphor. And I think the Tocqueville is kind of function as image that then we can tie into. Another word I don't use is application.
Yeah.
I don't use the word application because I'm thinking in terms that it becomes this list of 5 or 6, 7 things I need to be doing, rather than always living out. I use a different word. I use the word concretization. And a concretization is how then on Monday or how then on Tuesday can the story be concretized in my life where I can live this out as well as part of my story. That this is my story. It is present tense. I'm living this out in my life.
Right.
And that can be concretized in some ways. And it's not that the word application is a bad word. It's primarily because of the way the word has been used in previous ways, I think, to actually get people away from the text.
Yeah.
And I think, so it's the misuse of the word, not the way that...
So the whole sermon creates this concretization.
Yeah.
All heads in one way.
On Monday at 3 tomorrow... then that could be a way that it's concretized in the life of the church.
And surely you're right. It does. It has to pay off in the 21st century.
Yeah.
Right. We're not history teachers.
Yeah.
Right. Though that's okay too.
Yeah. We live with live people. Mark lives with dead people.
I live with dead people.
Preachers live with live.
Which I prefer, frankly. They don't answer back.
They don't open things up for questions and answers.
They don't. They laugh at all the right places. It's all good. Somebody else. Thank you. Yes, sir.
I am at a church right off from the University campus.
Mm-hmm.
Preaching weekly, 70% white, 20% black, 20% college students. We also have another 20% in there.
Okay.
We are in between youth ministers right now, so I'm working with the youth group, which is really good for my preaching.
Yeah.
And what I'm realizing is that, these people are living in different worlds, in some sense, okay?
Yeah.
And so it's hard. But I'm
from each other, you mean?
Yeah, from each other.
Right.
And so I'm just asking a question. When we talk about trying to connect the narrative of the congregation with the narrative of the text, what I'm doing right now is I'm kind of having to choose Sunday by Sunday, maybe which two groups I'm going to, I want to make this...
Yeah. Stephen, jump in there. I have.
Yes, I think you do. I think you're already way ahead of the game by having this awareness that the people who comprise our community of faith here are coming from, they have sort of their own, and so I think you have to say, okay, am I always preaching, when I have the congregation in mind, is it primarily this congregation or this part of the congregation? And if I'm only thinking here, then that's going to be alienating, so I think you have to have that. I think you also have to think about, are there places of overlap? Are there places where this sort of touches all of us, maybe in different ways, but all of us? And this text may be one of those where we can think across generations and across social locations and experiences about, if this text is about, let's just take this idea of what it means to converse with God or be invited by God into a conversation, I've discovered that communication patterns vary across the field, right? If I want to communicate with my daughters, I mean, that's not the only way, but that's one way, and they're very comfortable with that, right?
You don't call them to wish them goodnight or anything? That's good.
Just text them goodnight.
Yeah, good. Okay.
Just upstairs they get... I mean, that's an exaggeration, but you understand what I mean,
yeah, right?
Right. There's a way of envisioning this text, what it means to communicate with God, that breaks out of this sort of one-way communication where God speaks and I stand with, you know, sort of, I don't respond. Don't talk back to me. I don't want to hear what you, I just want you to hear me. And I think to paint that picture in ways and rotate that image across the cross-sections of the congregation would be one illustration of that. So I'm saying, yes, I think you do have to say, am I primarily moving in discourse with this group or that group? But I think you also, there are also places to say, are there ways in which this that this can move across all of these? And that's possible too, maybe not every time.
Yeah. I think there's a pressure point for male preachers too.
Yep.
Especially young male preachers.
Young male.
Yeah. Well, because 60% of our listeners are women, right? We need to be able to use things that surface with relate to them, their lives. And of course, their lives are not all of one piece either. Right? There's a variety there. But this is, I think, a blind spot for especially younger preachers, less experienced than you are. You know, how many young preacher sermons have you listened to with sports metaphors?
Oh, too many.
Oh, well, one's too many, actually. They're all terrible.
Kind of like narrow and wide.
Yeah, that's right.
I'll give you one. It was fourth and goal at the two. And I just stopped them right there. Just stop.
Just stop.
I've heard one of those. I've heard a hundred of them.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work.
Well, it never works. It's terrible.
No. So I'm just amening you, Mark.
Yeah, right.
Saying,
so, but I want to listen to those sorts of things. I mean, you know, I find graduate school stories never work. You know, I mean, so you're choosing experiences that are broad enough to relate to real people. When I talk about my dad's cancer and death, it almost always works, unless I'm trivializing it, which I would never do. So you're seeking the universal, as you're talking about, to cut across the particular, but I want to monitor those stories I tell, the language I use, so I don't hit everybody, the same group all the time.
I think that in some ways, when we pick a point of view, let's say a different one than we've mentioned so far, how many righteous people does it take to save a city? Which would be another theological theodicy kinds of questions. I think that you need to start asking yourself questions along the lines of how would a single mother, mm-hmm. how would a widow in the congregation, how does one of my elders in the church, how does the teenager... And you can start asking these kinds of questions. And if you're in the lives of these people in pastoral relationships, then you should also be able to think about that. If you're new enough to the congregation or you don't know, then why not call someone out for lunch and then just ask him, you know, I'm thinking about preaching this text. How do you read this text? And have those conversations with people as well. And then it becomes more of a dialogical process rather than an internal monologue that you're having. And so I think that once you have a point of entry, then you do have to start thinking about various folks. Let me give you a little different example, a different way of taking on this. I listen to Mike Pope quite a bit because that's where I worship. And Mike is a master in lots of ways in terms of images. I think he knows our culture pretty well. It's like a Nike commercial at times, where he is giving image, flashing image, flashing image, flashing image, flashing image, flashing image, shows you the swoosh at the end, never mentions the brand name, but you all know it's Nike. And I'm thinking, in terms of the way that I used to preach, that if I just had one of those images, I would make it ladder. I need to make it work. I need to save some of those other images for another day. But that's not the way are the TV and computer and web pages have made us think. They like this multi-flashing of images. Now, what I see about Mike is that oftentimes as he's flashing images, he's moving to different parts of the congregation where someone might catch it, and if they don't catch it, he's not worried about it. He's moving on because he knows that another image in a few seconds will grab him. And so he can flash it, and he's going to eventually gather up the consciousness of the community of folks and bring them all along, even though I might not have caught, I might have totally missed his muggles, and I still don't know what those are, that he makes reference to occasionally.
Because we are two of them. Yeah, we are muggles.
Yeah.
Well, I think there are a couple of other layers here. This is where this becomes relevant to preaching justice. Because part of what I want to make sure I do is I speak in ways that the person who is most marginal hears. Right? Concrete example. How do I preach about or teach about sexual purity? How will that be heard by the girl who's been abused? And I've never been in a church in which there were none of those people. And I'm guessing none of you have either. But how is that going to be heard? So I always want to ask that kind of question. And that means, back to Tim's thing, we really have to know our people and listen carefully. And none of the kind of drive-by preaching that I do, you know, I preach about every other Sunday, but it's just all over the place. The most important thing a person can do, I think, in moving to a new church is to study that church. And that's true, even if I've been there a while and haven't done that, just keep listening. Somebody else, we have about 10 minutes. Yes, Phil.
You guys have been talking about how, you know, with these texts you kind of tailor it to different people and, you know, flash the images that grab different people. Is it also possible that, you know, maybe on the other side, that different texts speak to different people? That maybe, you know, with one particular text, you're not going to be able to reach each group in your congregation, but that this is a text in a week for one particular group, whereas next week you move on to another text that'll be for a different group. I guess in the context of Genesis 18, I'm thinking of Genesis 22, a few chapters later, where God and Abraham have another conversation, and Abraham's boldness is completely gone, you know, when God tells him to sacrifice his son. And so it's just a completely different dialogue with God, a completely different approach to God, that different people are going to relate to each text. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, in one sense you can tailor a text to speak to different people, but is it also true that different texts are going to be more geared to different groups of people?
I think you're right, although I think that what I'd want to do And I've did this as a, like every 2 years when I was preaching full time, is I would write out topic text and just have one sheet of paper where I could see and do an analysis of where are the gaps, where are the silences. I can do that with text. Am I concentrating just on narrative text and forgetting the prophets? Mm-hmm. Am I leaving, I'm doing a bunch of Paul but no Gospels kinds of stuff. But I'm also maybe asking the questions, are there folks in the congregation that are not being touched? Am I somehow ignoring singleness? Because it seems like all my relationships are with married folk, and therefore I've got this gap or this silence in my preaching about folks that are single. And so I think that kind of analysis needs to take place. Otherwise, we will get too narrow. We'll get in one focused way, and we don't even realize that we think we're being broad when actually we're not, because we don't do any analysis of our preaching.
Yeah. Stephen, you want to jump in there?
I think you're right.
Sure.
I think you're right, though. I would want to clarify that it's not as though a text has a single particular audience that it's most suited for. I mean, it may be that there are a couple of different ways to go here, and the preacher stands in that space of trying to negotiate that and makes homiletical choices.
Right.
You know, there is this idea that a text has a single point for a single application, and I think we probably need to think twice about that. We make homiletical choices. We make interpretive choices, and the text as a living word calls for that. So, yes, it may point us one way more than another. But we need not be blind also the fact that it can also, we can make other choices too. So I'm just clarifying there.
Yeah.
What it's worth.
That's great. Thank you. I was so grateful this week we're not doing John as our series, because I've never been able to make heads or tails of John. And yet I know lots of people who think this is, who love John. You know, Leviticus, I get Leviticus. But John, not so.
Romans, but you still chose Genesis 18.
I like Romans too. I think I get that too. But okay, somebody else.
I think the text itself, in relationship to your question, underlying the thought being, even I can talk to God and have a conversation with God.
Yeah.
That's universal to the church then, that teaching,
right,
that listen, I can be personable with God, I can sit down and have a conversation, ask him, why is this happening to me? Maybe that's a bad example. Ask just have that conversation with God and question anybody.
Right.
Question, you know, God applies it like that.
That's right.
You're prompting also just some basic ideas about how to preach narrative as well. If conversation is the primary vehicle in which this particular pericope is moving the story along, then that gives me a clue about how I might preach it as well. Mm-hmm. Conversation would be a nice literary vehicle that I can do out loud with the people to make the narrative come alive. And why not have this conversation? Mark did some of that yesterday in class with the conversation of you know, should I save Lot? Shouldn't I save? And you gave some of these things that Abraham didn't say,
right,
and you can offer those as options in terms of how the conversation goes forward.
Right.
But one thing the text doesn't do, the text doesn't psychologize. I don't know of any of these Old Testament narratives that try to get into the psychic of characters, but we love to do that. Movies seem to like to do that. The text doesn't do that. The text does not do a lot of explaining or a lot of description. The problem is with a lot of narrative preaching is we spend a lot of time describing things and people get bored. And we think, well, I'm in narrative. I'm telling a story and we're describing so much. But the text of the language is the economy of language.
Right.
And so it's crisp and it's clean and it's moving forward. The text, again, this whole idea of description versus action. If I want to talk about the emotion of someone being sad, instead of talking about that as an emotional kind of thing, I can give actions about tears. Right. And let, you know, tears and the action of tears communicate sadness. I don't describe sadness. I mention the tears. And that's another way the text works that I can imitate. And so I think that helps our narrative preaching. And just there's several of these. I just don't have them all memorized.
Well, and so there's a real concreteness to it. Again, back to David Fleer's sermon yesterday, he's talking about he lit up a stogie, right? They passed around the bottle of whatever that was. And it was in the cupboard, and it's, you know, very concrete kinds of things.
You can visualize it.
And you could visualize them, that's right. We have time for maybe one more, and then I'll let each of you make a summary statement in which you give us the secret to great preaching. One more question or comment? Yes, sir.
Sorry, one thing that as someone sitting in the audience and maybe not hearing the sermon is particularly relevant to me. My space now, you might be arming me to talk to someone else that I'm running to that got crazy in my way.
Yeah.
Later on. So I think it's always relevant, even though it might not be relevant to me, it might be relevant to my education so that I can share this with someone. It's always good.
Will Wellman would also often say this phrase, "You're baptized. You know, you have responsibility to hear this sermon as well, be a listener."
Says, right.
And I'm not, as the preacher, going to necessarily play it all out for you. You're baptized, you're responsible. Take that responsibility seriously. And I like that sharing of this preaching moment is a shared moment between congregation and preacher. It's not just all on my shoulders to carry the weight of the preaching moment.
I think that's really important because we are performers as preachers, and we become obsessed with good performance, and rightly so. But we recognize that this really is an action of God. We take seriously the fact that the word preached is the word of God, and therefore there's an obligation of the hearer to listen. You know, I'm not an entertainer that you can just turn the channel on. I'm supposed to be speaking for God. If I'm not speaking for God, then I shouldn't be speaking at all. So that, I think, is worth reflecting on theologically, that it might be worth our reclaiming that sense of calling a bit and not suffering from the low self-esteem that we sometimes do. So 30 seconds each, and we'll close this down.
A whole 30 seconds, eh?
Yep. 20 now.
Well, thanks for that.
Yeah.
That's a good place to land, actually. So I'm almost going to leave it there. But that God is at the center of these texts, and too often they become anthropocentric. They're about what we should do, or what a character in the story did or didn't do as a moral example for us, and that they become these sort of moralisms about living. And God is eclipsed in that. And so His work, not only in the space of preaching, but in the space of these narratives. And we said that from the beginning. Maybe the primary question to bring to text is, what is this a narrative text relative to the topic of justice and righteousness? What sort of God is this that moves in and beneath and through this text? And particularly in this text, how is He inviting me into the space of that, literally, to work this out? Which implies that He actually wants us to work this out with Him. That He doesn't have it all prefigured out there, and He's just you know, going to lay it all out there. But that in the space of God's movement toward the end of all things, He's invited us to work in the messiness of all of this and to wrestle with it, and so to discern and embrace and participate in His reign. So.
Thank
that was
you.
Longer than 20 seconds.
That was wonderful. That's great.
My last word is just, tomorrow is prophets. And that stuff's tough. And how do you preach a curse, you know, to a little West Texas congregation of 20 that, you know. And so tomorrow, as we talk about prophetic preaching and we actually move towards prophets, I don't think it gets, you know, we started easy with narrative.
Right. But we have some things to say tomorrow, and it'll be excellent, I hope.
I hope.
Thank you both. Thank you both for your great work. We appreciate it.